I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Pets are a big part of life in America. According to the North American Veterinary Community, some 85 million households in this country have a pet, with cats the most popular pet. The cost of keeping a pet isn't cheap. Americans spent about $40 billion on healthcare for their pets last year. But there's also evidence that having a pet in your life can improve your quality of life and your health. Well, we're joined by Dr. Lynn Honickman. She is a veterinarian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Tom Bond. He is the CEO of NAVC. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
So, Lynn, there are a lot of pets in the United States, right? Some 85 million households with pets. That's a lot of people
with pets. It's a lot of people with pets. Mm-hmm. We can't live without them.
And when did cats overtake dogs?
Just a couple years ago. So it's probably lifestyle situations and maybe some people who work long hours think they're easier.
What kind of pets do you primarily deal with?
So I mostly work with dogs and cats, but I also will see exotics. I'm a general veterinarian who sees only behavior problems. Mm-hmm. So the patients that I see are very troubled. And mostly dogs and cats, but I'll see some birds, some guinea pigs, some ferrets.
What does a guinea pig with behavioral issues present like?
Well, a family might have a guinea pig that's biting them, and certainly that's not what's thought of as a good pet. Mm-hmm. And guinea pigs live with a lot of children, so sometimes typically those kinds of issues are often handling and management problems. So sometimes it's educating the family and to how to address the needs of the guinea pig in a way that's not going to scare them.
Do you see some kind of pet trends too, like? One year, it might be like pot-bellied pigs are trendy, or maybe the next year, it's like canaries or something. Like, what kind of pets are in these days?
Well, absolutely. And so that often goes along with movies, right? So when Disney comes out with 101 Dalmatians and everybody wants a Dalmatian, we were joking with Tom earlier that he has an old English sheepdog. And so if you're old enough to know, you know, the Shaggy Dog movies, you know, you might think of that. And currently, there's a lot of conversation about the new Keanu Reeves movie. And I think there's some Belgian Malinois in there that look pretty cool.
Are you talking about John Wick 3?
Yes, right.
Right, which is an action movie with a pretty high body count, I understand. But
not a high dog count.
Right.
Right, that was one of the things that viewers, I think, were most concerned about.
Right.
Absolutely.
The dogs are not harmed, according to my sources. But people might look at that movie and think, wow, I think I'd like a Belgian Malinois. But they are not typically pet dogs. And
yeah, they're fierce.
They're extremely intense, and that should not be something people look for in a family pet.
So, you know, all these new movies coming out of summer, do you sort of look and see, you know, which pets are we looking at? What do we need to tell vets to be aware of in terms of the kinds of animals they might be seeing in the next year or two?
Yeah, it can be interesting. We do kind of keep our radar alert to those things. And, you know, the Secret Life of Pet movies, I think part two is coming out this summer. And so people have been sending me trailers. And apparently there's a veterinary behaviorist in the movie.
So
I don't know
they're
exactly what the plot line is, but I'm anxious to see if we're well represented.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, tell me about your role and maybe some of the changes you've seen in kind of people's pet choices and the place that pets play in people's lives these days.
Yeah, I mean, and if you put it in perspective, and you mentioned the fact that 85 million households, I mean, it's just an incredibly enormous number, but $40 billion are spent each year on our pets' healthcare. And what's so significant about that is the fact that pets have become such an important part of our everyday lives. So you always see the stories about service dogs and all the heroics and the incredible things that they're doing to support people with PTSD and other types of things. But the reality is that they're helping people every day within their families. So we've been working with the human-animal bond focus of this whole thing, which is really showing that pets have significant positive health impacts across the board. And we're talking about reduced blood pressure, better commitment to taking their medications. You know, we were just at a event a couple weeks ago, and the former Surgeon General, Dr. Murthy, he was talking about the fact that loneliness is an epidemic right now in the United States, believe it or not. And he said that the impact of loneliness was equivalent or greater than 14 cigarettes a day. I mean, could you imagine that for just a second? And he said one of the key ways to deal with that is pet ownership, because pets can bring so much to your life. It gives you a purpose every day. And all of our research has shown that. So we really have gone from this, you know, I remember we were talking in the lobby about when I was a kid, you would see dog houses in people's backyards. Well, you don't see that anymore. Dogs are very much, and cats, integrated into the family household, and so important at every single level to the family.
Tom, did you grow up in Florida?
I didn't grow up in Florida. I actually grew up in New York, which was probably another reason for the doghouse. But those cold, brutal winters, you know, you don't see that anymore. You see absolute immersion into the overall family. They're basically, we call them the owners, pet parents now. Mm-hmm. We don't call them dog owners or cat owners. They're pet parents because for a lot of people, we're having, by the way, I don't know if you saw this, for the first time, Americans are having less kids. A big part of that, I think, is that they're finding real value and completeness from owning these pets.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty, speaking to Tom Bond. He's the CEO of the NAVC, also talking to Dr. Lynn Honickman, veterinarian. Lynn, what about that companion animal? Is it a bit of a fine line for vets to tread if somebody says, look, I really get some value out of my companionship with whatever animal it is, but at the same time, there are people who have specific needs. They may need a seeing eye dog. They may need an animal for helping them with PTSD. And there are other people who are just like, I want to take my cockatoo on a plane, and maybe they're pushing those boundaries a wee bit.
Right. The boundaries absolutely need to be respected because there are people who need service dogs for specific skills. So we kind of categorize them into service dogs versus emotional support dogs versus therapy dogs. A therapy dog is the easiest dog that just kind of visits people in hospitals or is specially trained and has good manners and has good social skills and can visit VA hospitals and things like that, which has a great benefit to a lot of people. Service dogs absolutely help people who are who have vision issues, physical issues. And so those dogs can perform a specific skill and are absolutely allowed to go places with those families. And yet emotional support dogs, the actual distinction of what their rights are is very blurry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's really only one that's recognized by the ADA, which is really for disabilities, and they have to be actually trained to provide something for them and actually be able to do that act. Mm-hmm. So that's where it became kind of a little blurry when people were just saying, well, I need my puppy here because, you know.
It helps me feel better.
It helps me feel better. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think we need to be a lot more focused on people who truly are in need versus I just want to travel with my pet. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons we started the Human-Animal Bond Certification through NAVC was to really begin the conversation of what these pets mean, what the responsibility is. And to give veterinarians really the tools to understand, because you know, they're doctors. They're highly trained, incredibly smart doctors. And just like human doctors, some of the things that they're not necessarily exposed to as much as they should be is bedside manner. And you see, if you look at the equivalent. So what the Human Animal Bond Certification really helps them work through is these pets are practically children for a lot of people. How do you have the conversations with them about care? How do you have the conversations with them about, you know, end-of-life care or other types of things which are going to be coming up or become really important. And that's, I think, why this certification was so important. These are all things that veterinarians kind of know, but it kind of brings it all together, I think, in a way that they're able to have those communications with the pet parents.
So, Dr. Honickman, is this certification, is it effectively like saying you are able to kind of talk to the humans in the human-pet relationship about this? Like, what does it actually mean?
Right. What it will allow is for everyone to understand the role that animals play in our lives. And from a behavior aspect, you know, we see the results of that broken relationship. So when a pet has behavior problems, we see a deterioration of the human-pet bond. And that's exactly what we're talking about. And if we can understand our pets better, if we can understand that maybe they were abandoned at some point, maybe they didn't have the right kind of start in life. Maybe they came from a puppy mill. And so they have issues. And if we can understand those issues and we can address them from a medical standpoint and not just think of them as naughty or bad dogs, then we can help enhance that bond and we can be on a better playing field, a better understanding of what do the humans need in this relationship, what does the pet need in this relationship, and how do we serve everybody?
Are people getting better at not abandoning their pet if they think it has an issue that they can't resolve? Like, is that kind of conversation become any easier?
No, actually, behavior problems are still the number one reason that animals end up in shelters and rescue groups because that behavior problem, and it might just be It might just be a dog that barks all day long, which is actually a medical issue if that dog is barking all day long. Or it could be that they're biting children who visit the house, which is an extremely serious issue. And so behavior problems are the number one reason that animals are relinquished, much more so than other medical problems. And so animals are losing their lives at very early ages, so between 1 and 5 years old, because of behavior problems. If we can get them through those behavior problems, then we can have a nice dog that lives a good long time.
As you say, a dog that is biting children or other visitors to a house, that's pretty serious.
Absolutely.
Can that behavior be trained out, or is there a way to sort of work through that?
Right. So we're not talking about training, because in training we talk about mostly just, good social manners and nuisance behaviors and jumping on the counter and things like that. So aggression and biting is often anxiety related. And so we're really talking about the brain at that point.
So is it medication?
Absolutely. It can be. So medication can be a part of that. We're looking at the brains exactly as we look at mental illness in people. And so what is causing this anxiety? What is causing this trigger reaction? And so we are addressing it with a full treatment plan that includes how we manage that situation so that everyone stays safe and so the animal doesn't feel threatened. And then behavior modification is different in training in that we're just trying to change the emotional response. We're not trying to get the dog to sit or stay or lie down. We're trying to get the dog to feel better about the situation.
But the tricky thing is you can't talk to the dog.
I mean,
you can communicate to a certain level, but you can't put the dog on the psychiatrist's couch and say, how are you feeling about this?
Well, that's essentially what I do, though, every day. So as a behavior vet, I am, welcome to my parlor, right? Tell me what your troubles are. And so we're looking at what caused this issue, but also how do we move forward? And so we move forward by positive reinforcement and creating positive associations. So if you're afraid of an unfamiliar man, okay, well, let's start teaching you that unfamiliar people actually predict great things. So every time at a great distance you see an unfamiliar man, I might feed you chicken, and that might be a really good thing. So if you see that man, you get chicken. And so
that's a pretty high bar for the dog.
Right? Well, so pretty soon you might walk around, the dog might look for men because that man might predict something really delicious. So we want to try and change that emotional response. We also want to teach that animal how to be calm. And so we actually do a lot of deep relaxation breathing, so similar to biofeedback in people, just how to calm that brain, how to calm that cortisol, how to get that adrenaline down. And so a lot of it is very similar in how we work with and address these issues in people.
What about when a pet dies? I mean, that's got to be tough for the human family of that pet, whether it's a dog, whether it's a cat, whether it's a bird, any kind of pet. I mean, and as Tom is saying, they're way more integrated into people's lives now. So how much of what you do also involves helping kind of counsel the human family of the dog, the cat, whoever it is?
That's a huge part of what veterinarians do on a daily basis, which is also why the stress level in the veterinary industry, the veterinary profession, is so high, because we are dealing with life and death on a daily basis and in a very different way. We are seeing these pets as a general practitioner from the time that they're puppies and kittens until their last days. Very few family doctors treat humans from the time that they're babies until the time that they're seniors. And so we are literally cradle to grave, and
You develop a bond with the pet,
exactly,
too.
Exactly, right. So 10, 15 years of being that pet's and that family's veterinarian is quite emotional. And so, yes, we help families ease that transition. Children, we help them. And then the other pets in the household absolutely can grieve as well. So I know when we lost my dog at 16, my cat was 17, and for a full month, she very much grieved the loss of her buddy. And, people don't think dogs and cats get along that well, but she was definitely mourning that loss. And some studies have come out and shown that humans will often mourn the loss of a pet more than they will, a person, another family member that maybe they only see, twice a year or once a year at Christmas, whereas that pet is part of their family every single day.
What kind of advice do you have for people who may have lost a pet recently?
I absolutely advise that that we do not ignore that. They go through the 5 stages of grief, just like we do with any other kind of situation, and that they understand that it takes time to work through that. My husband and I lost a cat at a young age. Due to a heart disease. So he was 3 years old, and we knew he had heart disease and we were treating that, but still his death was very sudden and he was only 3 years old. And there were absolutely people who didn't understand, oh, he's just a cat, or, well, you knew he was sick anyway, so this was bound to happen eventually. And no, I mean, it was absolutely a tragic loss. And even both being veterinarians, my husband and I still mourned that loss, you know, very significantly.
Mm-hmm. And what about advice for people who have more than one pet in the household? And as you say, pets are going to grieve one way or the other.
Right. So you need to just make that transition as smooth as you can and give attention to the one that's left behind. And, you know, some people will get another companion, but we encourage them not to make the mistake of trying to replace that first pet necessarily, or to think that first pet is going to fill that hole in the same way. We were talking recently with some other professionals about the my first dog syndrome, because as professionals, we often hear stories about, well, my first dog was, you know, perfect, and my first dog did all of these amazing things, and now this dog. And sometimes it's just that, you know, fuzzy memory that you don't remember that the first dog as a puppy also ate your shoes, right? And so we hear about that first dog syndrome. So in moving forward, you need to understand that your next pet is not going to be the same as your first pet. And yet you still can have a different relationship with that one as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's next, Tom? This seems like a kind of a growing and evolving field, especially thinking about the psychology of pet ownership.
Sure.
As much as the kind of physical needs that pets have.
Yeah, so there's really two things. One is we're intensely focused on getting word out about the human-animal bond certification and making sure that consumers, pet parents, know about that, so they know that their veterinarian has connectivity to that. But we're also focused as well on this other piece that Dr. Honickman brought up, which is the incredible levels of stress that veterinarians are going through because of what we call compassion fatigue. That's what she was alluding to when she talked about this whole issue of the fact that a typical veterinarian has to put down, you know, all these animals each week. So right now, veterinarians have one of the highest rates of suicide of any profession.
Really?
It's very, very bad. It's a tough situation that we're dealing with. And there's a whole bunch of factors combined into that. Compassion fatigue is one of them. The fact that they are these brilliant doctors who come out and aren't taught how to run businesses, but they're essentially small business folk in many cases. So there's all these different stressors and the dynamics of the economy and what vets make and student debt.
And the fact that most veterinarians are type A personality perfectionists, and actually that's what the vet schools look for.
I wasn't going to say that. You're a veterinarian.
I will admit it. I'm a full-blood card-carrying member of the Perfectionist Society. And so the vet schools choose this personality. And then we get into the veterinary industry, and often we're not allowed to do what we know we can due to a variety of factors, due to client finances. Mm-hmm. You know, so people might bring in a very young animal that was hit by a car and has a broken leg, which is something we absolutely can fix, but maybe that client can't afford to fix it, or there's something else going on in that household and they just can't emotionally deal with that trauma.
Lynn, all of these challenges that vets are facing, people still want to go to veterinary school and become a vet, do what you're doing?
They still do. And I do encourage it. I think that if somebody is passionate about this profession, then there are a lot of things they can do once they do have their veterinary degree. You can go into general practice, but you can also go into research. You could go into government work and industry, all of the different species. So you could go into zoo work, or you could go into large animal food production and things like that. So if somebody comes to me and says, hey, you know, my high school age or my middle school son wants to be a vet, I'll have a serious talk. And we do talk about the cost risk benefits and that the vet schools are quite expensive.
Is it the same as getting a medical degree?
Right. So it's often 8 years, 4 years of undergrad, and then 4 years of vet school.
And then you've got to specialize in whatever animal.
Right. And
a lot of people say harder.
Yeah. And, well, because we're learning all the species,
right?
Not just humans. So it's a long journey. And then when you get out, you're making significantly less income than a human doctor with huge debt. So there are veterinarians who are graduating with at least $100,000 in debt and up to $300,000 in debt.
Yeah.
And how do you dig out from that if your only starting salary is $60,000 a year?
What is the most unusual pet you've ever treated?
So I worked actually wildlife rehab, so I can I've seen quite a lot of different animals. Chicago area, I did a lot of raptors and hawks and owls and things like that. Pet wise, I think people are I think, steering away from the crazy, ridiculous exotics. You know, we used to see a lot of sugar gliders, I think, was the exotic
That's like
pet.
A kind of a squirrel.
It's like a flying squirrel.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so we would see sugar gliders and ferrets and things like that. I think more and more people are realizing that these exotic animals are quite a lot of work.
Thinking about everything you've said about what it's like to be a vet and all of the kind of stress you go through, are there some cases that kind of stick in your mind, like you sort of mull over and think, if only I'd done this or if only I'd done that?
So for me as a behavior vet, on the same lines that Tom was saying that maybe there's going to be this shortage of pets, I think that I would amend that by saying maybe a shortage of quality pets.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because I think that what's happening is that our shelters, many shelters are full of pets.
Now, can you say there's such thing as a quality pet? That wasn't the quality of the owner that's really...
Well, what I was going to say is that these shelters and these rescue groups are extremely full of pets with troubles. And so so the cases that I mull over and really mourn are the ones that typical family goes to the shelter on a weekend and says, we're going to add a dog to our family and this is the right time and we're planned and we researched it and we're ready. And they adopt this dog from the shelter and they get home and it has a lot of behavior issues because we don't know their history. I always tell my clients, I wish they could come in with their biography in their pocket and say, okay, here's what happened to me and here's all the baggage that I'm carrying around.
And it must be a bit of a catch-22 for the shelter too, because their job is to try and get as many of these pets placed in homes as possible.
Exactly.
So I wonder if there's sometimes a bit of like, do I tell them absolutely everything that this dog or this cat has going on or not?
That's a huge problem. That's a huge problem that there isn't always full disclosure, especially in some rescue groups. And everybody kind of thinks that everything can be fixed with love. Well, here's this very, very fearful dog, and he's aggressive, and he's hiding and cowering in the back of the kennel, but he just needs a family to love him, and he'll be fine. And again, we talk about the fact that these are often brain disorders, and so early trauma or early neglect or lack of socialization actually changes your brain development. And so now you're a 2 or 3 year old dog with a different brain than an average 2 or 3 year old dog. And this is a real problem. And so it's a significant problem for families who say, this is not what we signed up for. And now what do we do? Because now maybe we're going to have a lifetime of trying to manage this behavior problem.
Well, and those costs are so significant to the pet parent. So if you look again in places in Europe, you're going to see over 40% have pet insurance. Where here, it's less than 2%.
What does pet insurance cover?
Pet insurance, well, depending on the
like
type.
Medical insurance?
Absolutely, yeah. So it can cover everything you typically other than pre-existing conditions. But even now, there are a number of wonderful insurances out there. And I, you know, when all my friends get puppies or dogs, I tell them right away, go and get pet insurance. You can get it so inexpensively now. There are some great plans out there. And keep that because it'll be so much more beneficial later because it could become very expensive. And you don't want the monetary aspects of it to be a, you know, withholding you from really taking care of that pet, whether they are mental health issues for the dog or just, you know, some traits that we know certain breeds can get and have issues with.
And for me, especially, the problem is that by the time I see the troubled pet, they've gone down a wrong path already. And so they've gotten information.
It sounds like a wayward kid.
The family has gotten information and advice from anybody other than the behavior veterinarian. And
they probably just Googled it, right?
Right. So they Google it and they talk to their neighbor and they talk to the employee at the pet store and they talk to and they look online and they watch television and they see celebrity trainers and things like that. And so they fall into the whole dominance myth idea and they fall into aversive training. Well, if this dog is aggressive, then he needs a tough hand, which is actually the opposite. So, you know, the aggressive dog is actually feeling quite threatened and we need to, again, like I said, change that emotional response, not punish it. And so by the time I see these families, they've already spent thousands of dollars, unfortunately, with the wrong methods.
And then they're coming to you and saying, you've got to fix this because this is the end of the line
right.
for me.
So often, yes, I would have to say that, you know, a majority of my patients say that I am the last resort, which is a lot of pressure to have on somebody. And then they'll say, and we've already spent X, Y, and Z. And so you need to fix this quickly and not expensively. Mm. And so that really is tough because this is a journey. This is not something I'm going to fix in a two-hour session. This is something that's going to require months to years of change, and the whole family needs to understand that. And so then we also get into a little bit of family counseling because, you know, maybe dad's on board, but mom's not quite quite enamored of the fact that the dog is growling at the children.
So you have to know a little bit of human psychology.
Absolutely. Too. We often feel like we need to have our marriage counseling degree as well.
Dr. Lynn Honickman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me today.
Also joined by Tom Bond. He is the CEO of the NAVC. Thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Still to come on Intersection, for the first time, Central Florida leaders are joining forces to plan for climate change. And later in the show, Hannah Harbour and the Lionhearts released their debut album this year. Hannah Harbour joins us on Intersection to perform some of the songs from her new album, Long Time Coming. Intersection's back in a minute. I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. For the first time, local leaders from across the region are joining in a new effort to plan for climate change. The East Central Florida Regional Resilience Collaborative is the third of its kind in the state and the 19th in the nation. Here to tell us more about it is 90.7's environmental reporter, Amy Green. Amy, what exactly is this collaborative?
Well, this is an eight-county collaborative on climate change led by the East Central Florida Regional Planning Council, and it's aimed at organizing and leveraging local resources around a global issue. The collaborative is modeled after the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact, which is recognized nationally as a leader in regional climate governance. Here in Central Florida, this is the third in the state after another one formed last year in the Tampa area. Here's what the East Central Florida Regional Resilience Collaborative wants to do. They want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the region. They also want to mitigate these impacts through sustainable development that includes compact urban centers and the conservation of agricultural and natural lands.
All right, so why is this collaborative important?
It's a very dynamic region. As you know, Central Florida is home to more than 4 million residents, or 20% of the state's population. The region gets more than 60 million visitors annually and is home to one of the nation's fastest-growing metropolitan areas. Leaders here are bracing for climate change impacts to our fresh drinking water supply, agriculture and food security, public health infrastructure, natural resources, and the economy. Now, this is very new. The collaborative was formed in May and so far consists pretty much of two leadership committees composed of city and county leaders from across the region and also academics, emergency management leaders, and environmentalists. And that is it. Leaders hope to expand the collaborative by forging partnerships with more entities.
All right. So, Amy, take us to some of these communities in Central Florida. What is happening in these communities?
Well, in New Smyrna Beach, Hurricane Irma prompted a series of community meetings last year on climate change and resilience. And here's Clay Henderson of Stetson University's Institute for Water and Environmental Resilience.
I consider myself an old-timer in New Smyrna, and we've never seen the water rise as much as it did for Irma. It literally came 200 feet out of the banks, the river did, and flooded areas that had never been flooded before. There were significant areas on the beach side that were flooded. And so for the first time, people in New Smyrna, you know, realized something's going on here. We have to do something about this.
And there he's referring to the Indian River Lagoon. The year-long effort was very well supported by the community. The first meeting drew a standing room only crowd. After residents voiced concerns about growth management, city commissioners put a measure on the November ballot to borrow up to $15 million to conserve sensitive land, and voters approved it resoundingly. Henderson says there's still more.
Underway now with the work of the Regional Planning Council to try to identify where new flood zones should be. The flood zones that are currently established clearly aren't keeping up with the times and being able to understand that. The other thing has been to call upon get grant money, particularly federal money, to help homeowners take actions with their specific homes to elevate them or take other actions to protect them.
So he says awareness is growing on these issues. Other communities are less active, But he says as awareness continues to grow, more communities will take action and likely work together through collaboratives like this East Central Florida Regional Resilience Collaborative.
All right. So why is this collaborative happening now?
This is part of a pretty massive shift in how Florida is dealing with this problem. I mean, up until now, Florida hasn't really been a leader on climate change. I talked with Dan Krieger of the Association of Climate Change Officers, who characterized it this way.
Now, all of a sudden, you've got a Central Florida initiative. You've got a state that is hiring a chief resilience officer. You've got a Southwest Florida initiative that is emerging. There have been talks in the Tampa Bay, St. Pete area, and we're starting to see this come into fruition, which what it says is there's a recognition that there's a serious problem that needs to be dealt with, and people are finally, and governments and institutions are finally getting serious about saying, hey, we can't do this on our own. We're going to have to figure out how to work together on this.
And there, Krieger is referring to the chief resilience officer, Governor Ron DeSantis, says he plans to hire to coordinate a statewide response to climate change.
Amy, if the DeSantis administration is now taking action on climate change, why are all these regional collaboratives still necessary?
Right. And in fact, the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact was formed almost 10 years ago in response to state inaction on climate change. So again, in some ways, it remains to be seen how all of these pieces will fit together. For the people who I talked with, they believe there's strength in numbers. They think they'll get more done if they work together rather than just doing it alone. And that includes politically. Local governments, big and small, want to be heard, especially now as state policy on climate change is changing. And so, especially for smaller governments, aligning with a regional coordinated strategy is seen as empowering. The people who I talked with also point out climate change is a global issue that transcends government boundaries. They say it'll be hard for the state and federal governments to respond to all of the needs of local constituents. Again, here's Krieger.
Where the state can't really deploy the kinds of resources to help in a particular part of the state, the collaborative can come together to supplement that. It can also be a leader and help the state as it stands up in some of the areas where such an effort doesn't exist. This is a really substantial challenge that's going to require all hands on deck and not just looking upward. And so even with the state moving in this direction, leadership is going to be needed at all levels.
So Krieger makes the point that it's kind of like responding to a natural disaster like a hurricane. Sometimes local governments can respond quicker.
Amy, we mentioned the East Central Florida Regional Resilience Collaborative is the third of its kind in the state and the 19th of the nation. So how does it compare with these other collaboratives? Is it the same? Is it different?
Well, a lot of these other collaboratives are pretty focused narrowly on climate change. And Matt, you may have noticed the word choice there, resilience rather than climate change. We've talked before about former Governor Rick Scott's reported ban on the words climate change from state agencies and how DeSantis now is using these words. I'm told the word choice here actually is not political, but rather aimed at conveying a broader mission encompassing more than just climate change and flooding and hurricanes, but also things like affordable housing. Here's Lake County Commissioner Sean Parks, who is among the collaborative's leaders.
What we hope will happen is us all working together to address a lot of the questions and concerns that are probably on people's minds, whether you moved here a year ago or whether you've lived here all your life. How are we going to grow? How are we going to handle 1,000 people a day moving into Florida? How are we going to have attainable housing? What kind of jobs even are going to be available? Where are we going long term with as a region economically? What about this aging infrastructure? Roads that are falling apart, maybe roads that have not been built.
So the needs of Central Florida's coastal communities will vary greatly from those of the inland communities, and that's just one example. How challenging is it going to be for these local governments to work together?
Right. And just as another example, some of these communities will have large staffs working full-time on these issues, while others will have maybe one person working part of the time. These are just some of the challenges these local governments will have to sort out. But Park says these communities have a mutual interest in sharing ideas and resources.
Water knows no boundaries. Air knows no boundaries. water quality issues, for instance, that are affecting the west coast of Florida. Everybody knows, you know, the issues with algae, red tide. And, you know, we obviously know that that has always been an issue, but that pollution and water quality exacerbate the problem. Well, look what that's already doing to our economy. So if you only care about numbers, then you know that if we're not doing this together, eventually we're losing. We're going to, it's going to be a concern. It's going to cost you money in the long run. It'll cost money for your kids.
That's Lake County Commissioner Sean Parks, and we've been speaking with 90.7's environmental reporter Amy Green about the East Central Florida Regional Resilience Collaborative. Amy, thank you so much for joining me.
You are welcome.
Still to come, music from Hannah Harbour. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Hannah Harbour and the Lionhearts have a debut album out, and here's the title track from the album, Long Time Coming.
Long time coming.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Hannah Harbour with the title track from her new album, Long Time Coming. Hannah Harbour, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So your debut album is Long Time Coming. What was the process like of making that album?
It was really wonderful. We decided we wanted to... My band is called Hannah Harbour and the Lionhearts, and we had been talking about making a record for a long time, and hence Long Time Coming, I guess. But we started thinking about the process, I would say, about a year ago, with what songs we would want to put on it, and started raising a little bit of money ourselves, and then did a Kickstarter campaign, which helped us kind of get across the mark financially. Mm-hmm. And we recorded all of the instrumentation here in Central Florida at a studio in Castleberry called Pioneer Sound. And then went to Nashville to do the vocals and all the mixing and mastering.
So the two strands of the album, you had to sort of weave them together afterwards.
We did.
Was that a strange experience?
I think, you know, not recording the whole thing live, you know, you learn how to have multiple takes and multiple tracks. And mm-hmm. the studio can be a really unforgiving environment, but it can also be one that really helps you learn what a song really calls for and what your voice can do or what your instruments can do. And so we felt really proud of what we accomplished with the instrumentation, and have a great friend in Nashville who we knew we wanted to work with to do the vocals. And so I think going into it, knowing that that was the plan, kind of helped that mm-hmm. not feel separated.
And I was looking on your band's Facebook page. You mm-hmm. played at the Graham Parsons Dairy Down not too long ago. Yeah. Tell me about that.
That is such a wonderful venue. You know, the history of the place with Graham, and, you know, he painted the walls, and there's just this, you can feel there's a tangible presence of just goodness in that room. And it's run by a wonderful organization in Winter Haven. And they are really trying to get songwriters who not only love Graham, but just are really interested in honing their craft. And the room is quiet and wonderful, full of people who love music. And so I've been honored to be there. It's the second time that I was there. And we actually have our first headlining show there, March 30th.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like you're sort of fitting into a tradition of music in Florida, and is this part of it?
It's an honor to say yes, but yeah, I do think that that's, you know, we're hoping to honor those that came before us and also tap into whatever feels like an honest sound to be made right now.
Is there any instrument you wouldn't consider putting in your album? Like, do you kind of feel like you work within a narrow range of instrumentation, or there's some sounds that you're thinking that might be an interesting sound to incorporate into the next album or next song?
Yeah, I don't know if that, I can think of one off the top of my head that I would say absolutely no to, but there are things that ended up on this album, actually the Long Time Coming record, that I did not go into it thinking, oh, we're going to put this on there, including the producer, Thomas Wynn. He did some very interesting vocal sounds that ended up sounding more like a pad or a synth, but it's actually his voice in some of the tracks, and so we let ourselves branch out a little bit.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah. Thomas Wynn is also your husband?
He is, yes. Okay. Yes, he is.
The producer.
Yes, but he also produced it, and it's funny to have your creative life combined with your personal life in that way. And so, you know, we try not to let too much of that, like the connection that we have personally, be what supersedes, you know, a creative endeavor. Of mm-hmm. course it plays into it. But there were days in the studio where I had to, you know, take off my wife hat and just be like, okay, producer and, you know, artist in this role, and, mm-hmm. and try to manage that appropriately. He plays drums
songs?
On some of the songs. On one song on the record, he's playing drums, and he plays drums with us live sometimes. But the rest of the album is made with a drummer, Ryan Smith, who's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And Thomas plays guitar and does a lot of the backing vocals on it as well. And whenever I can have him live, he's a part of the band, that's for sure.
Do you ever feel like you just have to get away from music altogether? Like, do your holidays involve leaving your guitar behind, or do you have to bring it with you?
They used to. I think I compartmentalized music for a long time because it wasn't what I was pursuing full time, and I felt like it was not necessarily a worthy distraction. Thankfully, I've healed from a lot of that the older I've gotten. And so, yeah, they come with us for vacations. But I think, honestly, I don't know if we take real ones. We tend to add tour stops into places that we want to visit and call that a vacation.
Right.
So, you know, yeah, they're with us at all times.
Mm-hmm. Do you enjoy touring?
I do. I haven't done it much with this band, but Thomas's band, Thomas Wynn and the Believers, I've traveled pretty extensively with them. We did a European tour last year, and I really enjoy that pace. I think there's a freedom of being on the road that also, for me, it's interesting. I'm much more meticulous in my schedule and my my suitcase is gorgeously packed. And, you know, there's things about my life that I feel so able to be regimented when I'm moving like that.
Well, I wanted to ask you, too, about the sign, the symbol you have on the T-shirt. It's an old Florida motel sign that used to be up on 13th Street, Southwest 13th Street in Gainesville. It's now been taken down, but you've kind of immortalized this in some of your band merchandise.
Yes.
Tell me about why you wanted to put that on your T-shirt.
Yeah, well, I just have a love for old neon or old motel signs in general. I think, you know, growing up in a small town in Florida and you see so many of them driving old back roads or old highways. And I had driven past that Florida motel sign so many times going to school at the University of Florida. And when I knew I wanted to make something that was sort of Florida honoring, but not necessarily what you might envision for some of the logo art, that was what came to mind. And a local artist by the name of Shannon Staunton hand drew that for me. And now the sign has been taken down. So I do feel grateful that we've sort of let it live on in our logo.
Ballet Who in the Orlando Weekly called you one of the sharpest, most cogent roots voices in the city. Tell me about your sound. Like, how have you kind of crafted it? Are there certain artists you look to as your what you want to sound like, or what you're kind of emulating a little bit?
Yeah, I've learned about my voice, and I am so grateful for it that you know, when you start listening to different artists and you want to make music or you want to write songs, I think it's just natural to try to do the thing that these other great singers do. And then you might get dejected when you realize that your voice doesn't do that. And so I had some of that when I was younger and feeling like, well, maybe I'm just not that great a singer and maybe I'll just try to write songs. And then I realized, you know, the people who I really look up to, artists like Patti Griffin, she's kind of my end all be all. I would not be able to sit still or be normal in a room with her. Anyway, you know, it's not that she does have a really beautiful, powerful voice, but it's not the stereotypical powerhouse singer that you might think of. And the way that she was able to use what she naturally has to just convey emotion and to write these really powerful, honest songs. She was someone I and still do greatly look up to. As far as making a sound, you know, growing up in a small town there, and my parents are both big music fans, we, our vacations a lot of times would be traveling to festivals. And so on that circuit, you end up seeing a lot more of the kind of roots music scene. And so it was bands, you know, back then like the Avett Brothers and the Ducks. And I saw Nickel Creek before they were, you know, kind of wildly famous. And I just really latched onto this idea that you can sound however you want to sound and chase the muse however you'd like to, but as long as it feels honest to you. And so I don't know that I necessarily said I want to set out to make an Americana record, but I without a doubt write songs that are in that vein and have a voice that lends itself that way.
Well, Hannah Harbour, thank you so much for coming in and playing
for
us.
Thank you for having me.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last February. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Paola Chinchilla. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.
I packed the